And now, welcome to Who's Talking on WCHL with D.G. Martin. Interesting guests, enlightening conversation. And now, here's your host, D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. You have heard about pilgrimages. These are trips that religious people have taken all across the years, visiting holy sites and doing it in a particular order and visiting certain places. And, you know, we know about this from even from the time we were going to school. We learned about the Canterbury Tales, about this trip to the cathedral. So maybe sometimes you wonder, how in the world did this kind of crazy custom get started, and why does it keep on going? Well, our guest from the History Department at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Brett Whalen, is interested in these things, primarily in the medieval context, which is his area of specialty, but recently all assembled in a book called Pilgrimages in the Middle Ages, a Reader. And welcome, Professor Whalen.
Glad
to have
you
here. We talk about authors, and you're an author and an editor of this book.
Sure.
But what's it all, why do we need to talk about pilgrimages to understand our history?
Well, I should mention this book here is actually part of a wider series published by the University of Toronto Press on readings of medieval civilizations and culture. And so up to this point, they had a number of different volumes on the Crusades, on urban life, on medieval saints. So I think the whole idea of the series as a whole is to offer some texts that people can read and engage with these.
Rather than just having a textbook, they have reading, many of which are contemporary accounts of of either the sites or of the actual pilgrimage experience.
Yeah, and that's the idea behind the readers, is that they, in this sense, you're a historian slash editor, because you choose texts that you can provide excerpts of, translated into English, because you're not necessarily expecting everyone to be reading it in Latin, which would be nice, but, you know, keep it in English, and but choose documents that really help capture a sense of these different medieval sort of historical experiences. And pilgrimage, I think, is one of these medieval experiences that played such an important role in medieval life that it seemed like it was a good idea to add a volume on pilgrimage to the series.
Well, what was the pilgrimage like in medieval life, and why was it so important?
Well, you know, that's one of these big questions that's so hard to answer, in fact. You know, I was thinking about it a bit earlier, actually, that and I think there's a real wide range of reasons that people maybe even like to travel in general, and then pilgrimage
is just
kind
an excuse
subset.
I think sometimes people just
want to go see new stuff, right? You know, go somewhere new, the adventures of the open road, the sort of, you know, Jack Kerouac meets medieval pilgrimage. I think sometimes people want to experience some sense of being closer to a divine holy site, closer to God. And then, of course, in the Middle Ages, and I think this is quite different from the way we think of it nowadays, pilgrimage could be imposed as penance. You did something wrong.
Oh, so you were required to go on a pilgrimage as a part of your reconstruction or rehabilitation.
That's right. I mean, pilgrimage is a form of penance where you've committed sins, the basic idea of penance being that you then need to do something to make amends to God, which could be fasting, praying, but also going on pilgrimage.
Is there are two ideas I've got about pilgrimages. One is that I make a trip to a particular site, and I do something there, experience the waters, see the relics, do something, then I come back home. Then there's another idea, like of a pilgrimage, where I go to a series of different sites, like this famous one across northern Spain,
right, the Compostela,
that you visit a whole series. Was the typical pilgrimage in the Middle Ages just trip to Canterbury and home, or is it a trip across northern
Spain? That's a great question. I mean, one of the things that struck me putting together this reader was, I mean, first of all, I think the classic idea of a pilgrimage is the idea that you leave, you go to your destination, and you come back. And certainly, I think that really remains at the sort of core of how medieval pilgrimages worked. But certainly, some people, these would go on for years. You'd go to a whole series of different locations. Some would be more important, some would be less important. I mean, if you're going to Jerusalem, that might be your overall destination. But you stop in all sorts of interesting places on the way. And then something that struck me was, a lot of times people would go on pilgrimages when they were older, and maybe go to somewhere like Jerusalem or Rome, and then actually just stay there until they died.
Although
so they didn't plan on, it's a one-way ticket. You're not necessarily planning on going back, which I saw some of that and wasn't necessarily expecting to see as much of that as I did. And you know, I think a little less common, but you certainly see this associated with Irish pilgrimage traditions, is the idea of pilgrimage is almost just kind of an endless journey of wandering. You know, you'd see these monks who would just kind of go from island to island on the coast of Ireland and almost turn all of, just turn life into one big, long-lasting pilgrimage, so to speak.
So rather than holding up in a monastery, divorcing themselves from ordinary life, they divorced themselves from the life in the cloister by taking this
trip. Going out into the world.
And getting away from the discipline monotony of a life in one place.
I think it's important to get permission from your abbot before you took off and went wandering around. It is. In Benedict, there's a bit of a side point, but if you read the Benedictine rule, which is the 6th-century rules and regs for monks that became very popular in the Middle Ages, the guy, St. Benedict of Nursia, who wrote it, he was very clear that he wasn't into the idea of wandering monks. He calls them, like, gyrovagantes. Like, these are the guys who show up, maybe they eat your food, maybe they spend a couple days in your monastery. And so that idea of pilgrimage as a constant journey, some people weren't as keen on that as others.
Well, in the Middle Ages were different from the way things are right now. We would say to our contemporaries, hey, you need to take a vacation. You need to make a pilgrimage to Myrtle Beach and stay there, or pilgrimage to Hawaii like the president does at Christmas time.
Sure.
And so is that just the middle medieval equivalent of a vacation? Is that what a pilgrimage is?
I think for the most part it would not be. I mean, I think the idea behind pilgrimage is whether you're doing it voluntarily or you're doing it imposed as a form of penance, which again, if you sin, your priest might tell you need to make a pilgrimage to this place. Whether it's voluntary or imposed, I think a big part of what powered the notion of pilgrimage is something that was meritorious, you know, that was important to do, is because it was so hard. And the idea being that this is not supposed to be easy and not relaxing. You know, if you're lucky, you don't get, you know, kidnapped by pirates or killed by the roadside or get sick. I mean, half the people, I think, maybe not half, but a lot of people who went on pilgrimage might not have been clear that you'd even make it home.
So
I mean, it's dangerous. It's rigorous.
Yeah, that's an interesting. I mean, for us, travel to Rome is getting on an airplane and
right.
Raleigh-Durham, very painful. Visits to other airports to change planes.
Yeah.
But, you know, 18 hours later or even less than that, you're in Rome. I mean, you're there.
Which I try to remember that when I'm traveling and my plane gets delayed. I think, you know, all right, it's a 3-hour delay, but I could be taking a, like, 3-month boat trip or something like that. So you're right. The travel nowadays is so, I think we've kind of lost sight of how convenient it is.
Yeah.
That's not the case in the Middle Ages.
Well, I wonder, is the pilgrimage a straightforward religious experience, or are there other things in the medieval world, such a thing as a secular pilgrimage,
yeah,
or a pilgrimage
for
some other purpose, or is it straight out, as you look at it, set in the experience that medieval people had with respect to their religious views?
Yeah, that's another great question, and it's another one of these questions that I think is really tough to answer in any definitive way, because I think, again, you would have seen a wide variety of motives for some of these people going on pilgrimages, where I think certainly for some of them, and I think this just remains an important component. So one of the things I had to decide doing this book was, you know, how do I define pilgrimage? Because there's other types of travel.
I should have asked that first. What is a pilgrimage?
And, you know, I'm still not sure, even despite the fact I put this whole, you know, reader together. It's really hard to pin down, because people would go on these, like, say, on a journey to Jerusalem, and an important part of what was inspiring them and shaping their experience was a sense of religious devotion, wanting to be in the sites where Christ, you know, lived, died, was resurrected, you know, spent time with his apostles, performed miracles. But some of these same travelers would stop and visit friends on the way. Sometimes they'd be diplomats who are carrying messages to say, you know, from Venice to the Ottoman, you know, Sultan of, you know, in Constantinople, and would visit a bunch of churches in Constantinople. I guess at that point it'd be Istanbul, pardon me. they'd visit Christian sites while they were traveling. Merchants might be carrying out transactions, but also make a stop to a church. So it's like, where do you draw the line? try to come up with a percentage. You know, they spent 50% of their time in churches and 50% in the marketplace. So is that a pilgrim or is that a merchant who is spending some time expressing their religious devotion?
Well,
I took a very wide view of pilgrimage here, that any sort of travel, either long distance or local, made at least in part for the purposes of religious devotion.
That qualifies as a pilgrimage.
That's the description I use. And because in part, I wanted to try to cast the widest net and bring as many different types of pilgrims and pilgrimage into the book.
We're talking about the Pilgrimage in the Middle Ages, which is a book put together by UNC history professor Brett Whalen, and he and I will be right back to talk more about pilgrimages.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about pilgrimages. We're talking about pilgrimages in the Middle Ages primarily. And we're visiting with UNC professor Brett Whalen, who has assembled a book by that title. And I'm asking all kinds of questions, Brett, about pilgrimages and how they, just what their purpose was back in the olden days. One of the things that comes up is, did people primarily do this sort of by themselves, or did they have to get up with a group? And was there a pilgrimage service company that had guides that would take people in the Middle Ages to the site or sites that the pilgrim or the aspiring pilgrim wanted to visit?
Well, we were discussing before the idea of pilgrimage as actually potentially being pretty dangerous in an arduous journey. And so, you know, there's always, I think, safety in numbers. And so in that sense, as I was exploring these texts and putting them together about pilgrimage, you know, it did become clear to me that a lot of the accounts of pilgrimage are oftentimes centered, either written by a single person or, you know, written by someone else about a single pilgrim. So in that sense, certain pilgrims like Egeria, who's a 4th century Christian nun from Spain, or this guy, St. Willibald, who goes from Germany in the 8th century to Jerusalem, you know, individuals emerge as at the center of the pilgrimage experience. But when you start looking into it, you realize they're typically traveling in groups. I mean, you need to get on boats, you need to have pack animals to bring your supplies and food, you have to worry about bandits, and of course, you know, as you cross borders, there's maybe people trying to, you know, get tolls or bribes out of you. Sometimes these pilgrims would get thrown in jail when they go through local territories and maybe have a fallen, you know, get in trouble with the local authorities. So the group experience, I think, is an important part of the picture. But those might change. It wasn't necessarily like a travel service, you know. That's an interesting question. You know, maybe you show up at the hostel and you wait around for a couple of weeks and some other people show up and you decide to pool your money. You wind up buying passage on a boat. So you'd form these, I think, kind of like ad hoc pilgrimage groups.
Well, what were the places that were the usual destinations for these pilgrimages?
Well, there's the big... That's a good question. And again, it's you've got the kind of big ticket places like Jerusalem, of course, is I think, and certainly in my own work, I also work on the Crusades as a kind of pilgrimage, which perhaps we'll talk about. And Jerusalem is central, and the association with Christ in the events of the Bible, I just think make it into a unique pilgrimage destination. But then, of course, you also have Rome, which with the Pope and the whole tradition of St. Peter having been martyred there, and there's all sorts of saints' remains and relics in Rome. And so Rome is important. You have Compostela in Spain. Constantinople actually has a lot of churches and relics, the capital of the Byzantine Empire, which modern-day Istanbul. But then you have all these local shrines, too, where your pilgrimage might be 5 miles down the road to your local church where there's a saint's relic. And maybe you have gout or, you know, you're going blind in one eye, and so you just go 5 miles down the road, light a candle, say a prayer, hope that it helps.
Is part of the pilgrimage experience the hardship of this long walk or long travel? Is that part of the discipline, part of the idea that the pilgrimage is an important religious experience?
I think so. Particularly when pilgrimage is imposed as a form of penance, which we were discussing earlier, that when you sin and you perform penance to make amends to God, you know, that's not supposed to be easy. So maybe you live on bread and water for 6 months, or, you know, maybe you give money, you have to give up money and donate it to orphans and widows in your community. But then the idea that taking a journey, you have to leave home, you're gone for a year, you leave your family, you leave your friends. It's supposed to be a sacrifice, I think.
The other part of the pilgrimage, and this is just a diversion, but those of us who read Canterbury Tales when we were in the 10th grade or whenever we read that, we found out that there was some mischief that went on.
Sure.
On the on that kind of pilgrimage. And was there, did you find, and in your readings deal with the question of how you keep from messing around with the wrong kinds of people on the pilgrimage?
Hey, you know, Chaucer, it's funny in some ways that, you know, I think you're exactly right that Chaucer's Canterbury Tales is one of these really just emblematic pilgrimage texts. You know, people, when they think of pilgrimage, a lot of times, whether it's in their Western Civ class or in English in high school, you know, people have some idea of Chaucer. But in some ways, I wouldn't necessarily... It's tricky in a sense of just how sort of... how much Chaucer might be capturing a sort of genuine religious experience. I mean, the guy's a writer, you know, and so a lot of what he's doing is he's inventing these tales, he's weaving all these different sorts of traditions and stories into his pilgrimage narrative. He's playing around. I mean, a lot of Canterbury Tales is
so this is just
comedy.
Fiction. This is just fiction.
Well, you know, I hate to draw clean lines between fiction and nonfiction, but certainly it's a very complicated literary text. You know, there's a lot going on in Chaucer. And, you know, that's very different, say, from reading a 4th century pilgrimage account, like the one I mentioned before by Egeria, where she was very serious about her pilgrimage experience. And, you know, she wasn't necessarily cracking jokes. Maybe she cracked jokes on it. I don't know. But when she wrote down what she did on her pilgrimage, she definitely didn't describe it as a particularly kind of playful experience that she had had.
Well, it leads me to another question about the religious experience. Both in the medieval times and the, I guess, would you call it the pre-medieval time? I don't know.
Late antiquity, late Roman,
but,
Christian,
where antiquity. People are beginning to deal with this drive of certain Christians to visit holy sites.
Yeah.
And that was there a universal agreement that this was a good thing for good Christians to do?
Yeah, there wasn't, in fact. And, you know, particularly where, say, Jerusalem is involved, just to give you one example, if you read the Bible, you get to the book of Revelation at the end, you know, the new Jerusalem, the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of God, is the Jerusalem that is not of this world. And then you have the Jerusalem that is actually in the world. You know, you can get on a boat or a mule or whatever or walk there. And for some Christians, that earthly Jerusalem is a sacred place. And this is where Christ literally walked the earth and the other apostles. But I think quite early on, as early as the 4th century, you saw some Christians who thought, you know, going to the earthly Jerusalem, that's maybe more of a distraction. And your eyes should be on the heavenly Jerusalem, the next world, not necessarily caught up in this one. And I do think part of the criticism relates back to the question you asked a minute ago, is that certain critics said, hey, you know, why are people going on pilgrimage? Is it to have a good time? Is it to maybe, you know, there could be hanky-panky going on in the hostels late at night, or, you know, people getting, you know, drinking wine while they're traveling, telling stories. And so I think some people... we're really skeptical, maybe, about just how pious some of these travelers were.
Well, the same kinds of things happen with respect to modern day religious activities, that people worry about non-religious things that might occur whenever people get together for
That's
an
right.
activity. And but there were some. I think you're getting at this, but there were some of the people who wrote in your book who were really very skeptical about this as, in fact, just negative, that this was counter to the Christian culture to be absorbed with earthly matters like this. Think about your Heavenly Father, not what's going on in some particular place.
Place and time, certainly. And, you know, one of the texts I included in here was an excerpt from Augustine's City of God. So, you know, Augustine's one of these leading Christian intellectuals writing in the late 4th, early 5th century, right around the time that Rome is sort of falling apart. And, you know, he's famous for this book, City of God, where he's talking about the idea that ultimately there's a city of man, that's the world in the here and now, it's a flawed place, there's the city of God. And that's the eternal kingdom of God. And, you know, Augustine certainly, I think, is someone who, you know, I think in some ways maybe thought of pilgrimage as more of a metaphor for life itself. All of our life is a pilgrimage. We are wandering through this life. It has a beginning, it has an end. And the true eternal life is the one to come. So, you know, you certainly don't want to be getting distracted by the things of the world, I don't think.
Was there a business-minded development in the Middle Ages among various towns and cities and locations to say, hey, it's a good thing when pilgrims come because they spend money. It's kind of like having the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte.
Yeah, having it in Charlotte this year.
So we're losing out an opportunity because our cathedral doesn't have anything. We haven't done a good job of telling people why they should come. I mean, was there a competition among the cathedrals, among the towns, among the various sites to say, you really need to come here if you're going to have a good religious experience?
Yeah, no, there certainly was because, I mean, as we've been discussing, I've been trying to suggest, you know, certainly I think religious motivations are key to the pilgrimage experience in the Middle Ages, but you could also make a buck. I mean, there's no two ways about it, that if you have pilgrims coming in, they're spending money in hostels, they're renting pack animals, they're eating, they're drinking, and so having a thriving sort of cult center of a saint shrine, some sort of making your city into a pilgrimage destination could be incredibly important for your town.
So if you could
get
a nail of the cross.
Well, I was just going to mention, this is where the relics become incredibly important, because a lot of times what becomes the kind of linchpin of your pilgrimage site is having some, you know, the finger bone of this saint or a relic from the cross. And monasteries, you know, if one monastery claims to have the head of John the Baptist and then another monastery claims to have the head of John the Baptist, you know, medieval people were more than sort of smart enough to figure out there's obviously one of these people are not telling the truth, right? And people would steal relics at points. There's this whole tradition called furto sacro, which is Latin for like holy theft, basically, where people would swipe relics from each other's monasteries and then write about it and say, hey, we now have the head of John the Baptist. You should come to our monastery, not to these people's monastery. So people could be pretty cutthroat about it when they had to be, which I don't think meant it was any less important to them religiously. I think they could be perfectly spiritual and try to make a buck at the same time, frankly.
What did they believe about the power or the importance of the relics?
Well, this is where a lot of the, I mentioned before, someone maybe having gout or being blind in one eye and going on a pilgrimage, because healing miracles, you know, one thing that remained sort of consistent throughout the time period I cover in this book, which really runs from the first, second, third century up to the end of the Middle Ages, is just how constantly you see the idea of pilgrimage centers as places of possible healing miracles. And the reason those healing miracles happen is because of the power of the saint. And so even though the saint is dead, and even though maybe you only have his shin bone, the idea is that the saint is living there in your community. And the saint is the one who can maybe help channel God's grace, you know, can help cure your ailments. And so that healing power, I think, is really important.
Would that be one of the major reasons to go on a pilgrimage, is to be healed or to have some bad physical condition taken care of?
I think it's a big part of the puzzle, actually. And a couple of the documents in there, you know, just one example, there's a point there I discussed the Shrine of Thomas Becket, right? The destination of the Canterbury Pilgrims.
Yeah.
And there's an account written about the miracles performed at a shrine in the 12th century. And it's basically a list of, you know, so-and-so came here from London and they prayed at the tomb, and the next day, you know, despite the fact they had a limp, they could walk again. Their hearing was brought back. Their cataracts went away.
I know. I love those descriptions of the miracles that took place, because it sounded like somebody was applying for a grant, and they said, "Look at all the
stuff
what's
going on here."
And they had to really stretch to make some of the accounts, some of the minor things that happened into miracles.
That's right.
Because they might not have been, they might have been accidental or not all that miraculous at all, but they had to be listed because we got to have a long list to show that this is really a good place to come.
And some of these texts, you know, this is what we would now call PR. I mean, they're looking to basically lay it out there that, you know, if you want to be cured, you know, this is where the action is, right? So
we're visiting with Brett Whalen about his book, Pilgrimages in the Middle Ages. He and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Brett Whalen. He's a professor in the Department of History at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he's the editor of all of the book, new book, The Pilgrimage in the Middle Ages. It's a reader, though, and so you've got the work of a whole bunch of other people who have written about pilgrimages at various stages. You start listing the places that all of us know about it, and one of the places that comes up is at Lourdes, always
sure.
The healing power of the waters there.
Sure.
And was that a medieval site for pilgrimages as well?
Don't quote me on this. I guess I am on the radio, so I am kind of putting myself out there. But
we won't tell you.
My understanding is, I mean, everyone go on Wikipedia, look up Lourdes, check it out for yourself. But, I've never understood Lourdes to be a particularly important medieval pilgrimage site, although certainly, we were discussing before how St. James of Compostela in northwest Spain was a very important pilgrimage site. And so what you saw was, as pilgrims passed through France, there sprung up a whole series of different shrines and places. Vézelay, I actually visited Vézelay myself a few years ago, which is in Burgundy. Lourdes might have started out as far back as then as one of these sites.
I'm just imagining, and I guess this is a question, but I'll have to frame it as I go along, and that is that people on their way to a pilgrimage, say in northern Spain,
right,
would pass through France, and so they would stop in towns, and somebody in the town would say, hey, we got these pilgrims here, we ought to have a site.
Should have a site of our own. I think that's right.
And maybe they could stay a couple extra days and spend a little bit more money here. And can anybody find a piece of the cross, or is there a relic for sale somewhere, or can we make one up?
To Rome and maybe buy one or dig one up in some cemetery where it's been.
Did that really happen, or was that just my business-like entrepreneurial?
There is a certain entrepreneurial attitude here, and typically when I think about these things, I feel people always have the ability to hold what we might think as are two contradictory ideas in their heads at the same time. And so I imagine for a lot of these townspeople or local churchmen particularly, because those are really the ones that I think would promote the stuff, they would see it as being a perfectly good Christian, perfectly spiritual thing to do, but also be thinking that they definitely wanted to put their town on the map. And why not, right? And have the pilgrims stop here and come to our church, our shrine, maybe leave some donations. So there is an economic side to this, certainly.
Well, we have pilgrimages today. I mean, this is off the time. We got a barbecue trail. You know, we've got a trail of African-American history that
right.
places to stop. And all sorts of a Civil War trail, a Revolutionary
certainly,
War
certainly.
Trail, places, important places to stop along the way. That's not really, question mark. Are those in the tradition of medieval pilgrimages, or is that just a different, that's just travelogues?
Yeah, that's one of these questions that, it's kind of fun to think about and play around with. Is in some ways, you might think that there's a tradition of what you might call secular pilgrimage. I mean, anyone who travels to Washington to go to the mall and see, the Roosevelt Memorial or the Vietnam War Memorial, I think you can see these as forms of almost like, American civic pilgrimages, so mm-hmm. to speak, going to Graceland, to visit the shrines to Elvis, so to speak, right?
Well, that's to visit the gods, right?
So,
that's to visit the god.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the god of rock and roll. I mean, there's certainly some people whose devotion to Elvis probably rivals, medieval devotion to the Pope or something like this. At the same time, I do think it's important to think about, really, in the 19th century, this is getting out of my area of expertise, but in the 19th century, in the early 20th, you really see the development in the United States of the modern tourist industry. And so, a lot of what we associate with travel, I think, is something from the last 120, 130 years.
Well, there are, in modern times, there are religious groups and business groups who do promote pilgrimage as a important not just as a vacation or a travel, but as a part of a religious or spiritual experience.
Sure.
And how do you feel about those as compared to the medieval pilgrimages that are described in your book?
Well, certainly, I think we'd be misunderstanding pilgrimage in the Middle Ages and misunderstanding medieval people to assume that they had some sort of set of religious convictions that made them not complicated people, and that somehow they were religious and that a modern person might not be, or something like this. And I can imagine people in the 12th century had a whole set of different things that might motivate them to go on pilgrimage. And you can probably say something about people now who are going on these sorts of journeys that you're describing, where, you know, if you have 20 people on a bus going to see the Mormon Tabernacle, you know, in Utah, you know, maybe some of them, it's a deep-seated spiritual experience. And for others, they've just never been to Utah before, and it seemed like a good chance to go on the trip. You know, I was in Jerusalem myself several years ago. I was really there as kind of for a historical pilgrimage. I mean, I'm a medieval historian. I wanted to see these historical sites. But I met people. I was staying in the Lutheran guest house there, and I met a woman. I had a whole conversation with her where she felt like being there and walking in the streets of Jerusalem made her feel closer to Jesus Christ. And I could tell it was a really personal, moving spiritual experience for her.
Well, and you stayed with the Lutherans, and are the other people who generally stay with the in these religious houses, are they pilgrims or are they tourists?
I don't know. You know, that's a great question. And I basically stayed at the Lutheran guest house. I went there with my mother, in fact, and it was a great location and reasonable rate, and they had a great balcony with an awesome view of the Dome of the Rock. I think there was I didn't know what I'd find there, and I think there was kind of a mixture of what we might call tourists and what we might call people who are there as pilgrims. Of course, my mom was there as a tourist with me, but she's also a devout Catholic, and I think it certainly was a meaningful experience for her as a Christian. So she was a mixture herself, tourist, pilgrim. I don't know. I mean, we could have her on the show and ask her, I guess.
Yeah, well, let's get your mom on here because, I mean, this leads me to a question I was going to ask in the next segment, and that is as pilgrims came, say, to Rome, or to Jerusalem, but particularly to Rome, and they found that the church was not really as they idealized it. And this
sure.
is, you're talking about the Catholic and Lutheran connection, that when Martin Luther came to Rome, I'm not sure what his business was, whether it was a pilgrimage of some sort or just a business visit, but he found the church not to be to his liking.
Sure.
And so there's, a disappointed pilgrim. And were there other disappointed pilgrims?
There certainly were. You know, there's one text in here by this 4th century Christian thinker, and his name's actually escaping me at this exact moment, but he already in the 4th century says, you know, I went to Rome, I really wanted to pray, I really wanted to go to the shrines, but I was so caught up in all of the business that I had to do there, that he was there, he's meeting with people, and I think he felt completely distracted by all of the church business that was going on in the city. I do think in the later Middle Ages, as you start to approach the time of Martin Luther, that it's starting to become a really more widespread concern, which eventually, of course, does lead to the Protestant Reformation. And this is one reason why we say the Middle Ages end. And one of my final documents in here is a text about Martin Luther. And the Middle Ages come to an end. And pilgrimage, as we've been discussing, pilgrimage doesn't end in the Middle Ages. It keeps going into the modern era. But I do think by the time of Luther, a lot of people had started to have some really serious reservations about what pilgrimage looked like, what the church looked like, all these saints' relics and shrines. People started to have some new forms of skepticism about it.
We're visiting with Brett Whalen, a professor in the Department of History at Carolina and also the editor of Pilgrimage in the Middle Ages. He and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Brett Whalen. He's a professor at Carolina in the History Department and is the editor and author of a portion of a new book, Pilgrimages in the Middle Ages. And we've been talking some about Christian pilgrimages, primarily, and religious-based ones. I want to talk about both on either side, but the tradition of pilgrimages, as you all describe briefly in this new book, there was a little bit of background for pilgrimages in the pagan world, in the pre-Christian
sure.
world. And how did that differ from what Christian pilgrimages were all about?
Sure. I mean, something I try to be clear at the opening of this book is that, you know, pilgrimage is certainly not an exclusively medieval or Christian phenomenon, even though that's the focus here. And so I did try to include some documents to illustrate that you had people going on pilgrimage in the ancient Roman and Greek world. Now, of course, you know, we typically use the word paganism to describe that there's lots of gods And so I think part of what you saw there was, rather than a place like Jerusalem or Rome occupying such a central role in the pilgrimage experience, that there was these multiple sort of holy sites, sacred groves, sacred wells, all these different local pilgrimage places that people might visit to have some sort of connection to the divine. And again, you see one element of continuity is healing miracles. You see people going to try to be healed. I think, though, with the Greeks and the Romans, you almost do see a little bit more of what we might see as a tourist attitude at play here. I mean, my colleagues in the classics department might disagree with me. I'm not sure. But it seems like there's almost this idea that, oh, while you're there, you should check out this great painting that somebody did on the side of this temple wall. And this is also where the battle of, you know, so-and-so is fought, and this one general lost his army here. And so they almost seem to be a little more of a, like, catch-all tourist-slash-pilgrimage experience.
Well, I want to now go to the other end, and if you ask many of us, what is the closest thing to a medieval pilgrimage is going on today? You'd have, I mean, my answer would be this is the Hajj experience in Islam, where this is really a part of a religious duty that to make the visit to Mecca and to the holy site there. What is the relationship between the Hajj and the medieval Christian pilgrimages?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point you raise. It is a fascinating distinction that, you know, as we were discussing earlier, pilgrimage in the Christian tradition is either voluntary, you know, it could be imposed as a form of penance where someone's telling you, you need to do this because you committed a certain amount of sins. But pilgrimage never really develops into having a central sort of obligatory place in the Christian tradition. And it does in Islam, where, as you were mentioning, one of the sort of five basic duties of a Muslim is to try to make the pilgrimage to Mecca at least once in their life. You know, I'm not an expert on Islam, so I can't necessarily speak to, you know, why it emerged in that particular way in the Islamic tradition, but it certainly did encourage, and I try to capture some of this with the documents in my book, an entirely sort of, you know, distinct but related tradition of Islamic pilgrimage. And what's interesting, too, is it's not just Mecca, but, you know, in the Quran, you know, Muslims certainly share a whole set of important figures like Abraham, Moses, Jesus. And of course, Jesus isn't the son of God for a Muslim, but is a prophet. So you actually see some of the very same or similar holy sites in Jerusalem coming into the orbit of this Islamic Christian, pilgrimage tradition.
Well, that's interesting.
So they're all bumping elbows. You know, there's Jews, there's Muslims, there's Christians. They're all kind of at the same places.
Well, one of the other things I want you to talk about very briefly, and you talked about your interest in the Crusades, and those of us who have this working knowledge of the Crusades without being experts, remember that one of the at least justifications for the Crusades was we got to protect the holy places and the routes to the holy places for our pilgrims. People to come. And was that, was that true? And was that a real reason for the Crusades? Or was that, as usual, in whenever you have a war, you have a cover-up story for it?
Well, you know, I think it's somewhere in between real and a cover-up story. I mean, certainly what you see is that when the First Crusade starts around 1096 and captures Jerusalem in 1099, and a lot of people write histories of the First Crusade within a couple of years after the event. And in their accounts, when Pope Urban II, he's the pope at the time, when he calls upon his listeners to take up arms and go to free Jerusalem, he describes all of these horrible things that are happening to the Christian pilgrims there. So people at the time were describing this. You know, my understanding is, if you dig around in the historical record, there isn't necessarily all that much evidence that pilgrims are being treated particularly horribly by the Turks ruling over the area in the 11th century. You know, there's some of these documents I've noticed where you can see, though, that people would get fleeced. You know, you certainly might get shaken down while you're on pilgrimage by a local, you know, Muslim border patrol or someone. They would charge people money to get into the holy sites. And, of course, like we discussed earlier, it was dangerous. Pilgrims would die. People would get robbed. Their ships would sink. So, you know, I think the idea that we need to get control of Jerusalem to make it safer for our pilgrims might have captured something realistic. But I think the Pope, too, really kind of, he was going all out to make it sound like there was these horrible, almost what we might say now, like atrocities being carried out. And, you know, in my understanding, it was really exaggerated.
And what was the result of all of this? Just in a word, what was the result of the Crusades to protect the holy places? Crusades accomplish?
What did they accomplish? You know, that's one of these. I don't know if it's possible to answer that in a word.
In 30 seconds.
In 30 seconds. I mean, you know, the Crusades, I thinking about it from the European side of the perspective, and again, you know, I'm not an expert on Islam, and I don't know if I can really necessarily speak to the sort of Islamic perceptions of the Crusade, but certainly in Europe, crusading becomes a very new, popular, and sort of powerful idea of what pilgrimage is supposed to be.
It's a big pilgrimage.
It is, with weapons. You're going on pilgrimage, and you have pilgrims at arms, basically. And so Europeans spend a lot of time thinking about crusading, and it becomes part of how they understand themselves and how they understand their Christianity in some ways. So, you know, I think we're still trying to hash out and figure out what the legacy of the Crusades
is. If you had one place to put on your pilgrimage list for either secular or religious, where would it be?
That's a good question. I actually went to Jerusalem 2 years ago and Istanbul last year, so I crossed those two off the list. I'm not sure. I've never been to St. James of Compostela, in fact, in Spain, which we've discussed several times today. And so I wouldn't mind
maybe
going up
there.
And if
you do that pilgrimage, have you got to walk? Can you just fly in, or have you got to make that walk?
You can choose. What a lot of people do, I think, still to this day, there's a series of hostels in towns along the way. Mm-hmm. So you can walk. You know, you walk 5, 10, 15 miles a day.
So if I just went there, I wouldn't get credit for the pilgrimage. I think
maybe you get some credit. But, you know, the further you walk and the more work you put into it, I think the more credit you'll get.
Brett Whalen, thanks so much for your book and sharing it with us and sharing some of your thoughts about the pilgrimages in the Middle Ages and at other times. It's been great to talk to you.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks a lot, DG.
And thanks to you for listening. It's DG Martin, and Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.